Welcoming in our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
What's up, Hard Rockin'?
Slayer of Stairs, and my goodness, you were racking up the miles a couple of days ago.
Do you think less of me, and will you fat shame me because I took a rest after 8 climbs and then again after 13 before doing the last 7 to get to 20?
No to both of those, because I always, you know, like most people, I judge your activity against what I can do. And I like to think I get out there and pick them up and put them down, but I got nothing. I'm a piker compared to you. So you have earned every moment that you've taken of a brief respite.
Oh yeah, it's bad when people compare. Don't compare with me, because you're not going to feel great about yourself, and you're going to take it out on me, because it's all about projection. It's not about growth. So everybody do your own wonderful thing. But yeah, 20 climbs of those stairs, which are 130, and it was hot, my friend. It was hot.
Yes, absolutely. All right, we got some things to talk about this week, as usual, a wide spectrum of topics, but I'm fascinated by this one because I don't really know where we're going with it, as we talk about things of interest that we found in the woods. Lead me, Colin, to wherever we're going.
Don't you like how I had like a little rule too? It's like,
yes,
it has to be, it can be animal related, but it can't be like, ooh, an otter or a platypus. I don't know what gets loose up in those Maine woods. So I thought we would talk about things that we found in the woods that were either related to animals or were related to people. Now, I guess like if you were in the middle of like the forest in Alaska and you saw some guy like just pop out from behind the tree, we could talk about that. But I was thinking, for instance, of, I always like to find snake skin. Like,
oh,
that's
yes,
really,
yes,
kind of a treat, right? Like, because I never saw like a snake actually shedding its skin, but there was this mysterious element to finding that, this whole just proof of a transformation, right? That was like sort of between this creature that went back to Edenic times and the very forest floor itself. So I thought that was a good one. Now you do one.
Well, it's interesting. Mine has changed a little bit since I got involved with my wife, because her mom is a botanist. And so as a result of that, I now follow my wife's lead, which is to get very excited about finding different types of scat.
That's great. I would say that, wouldn't you say that also, is it technically scat if we're talking owl pellets? That would be up there, right?
I think so. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and you can, it's pretty easy after a while, too, to like sort of be able to identify what's been there through that particular byproduct, really. And I was just out, there are all these rabbits now. They've migrated north, like throughout the city of Austin. I saw a rabbit in the public garden. I'd never seen that in like 20 plus years here or whatever it's been. And so they're just all these rabbits down by the harbor at the Starbucks. And so like you walk across the lawn and like you're hyper conscious of like looking where you're putting your feet. So it's tough not to know that. Or people have deer in their backyard and they chew up they chew up your garden. And it's like, oh, you can always sort of see the evidence. But another man-made one, or a couple man-made ones for me, was, and I wrote a story about this. It gave me an idea for a story. It wasn't actually from this. I haven't sent it to you yet. But I found in the forest behind our house an old cattle goad, which is like a cattle prod without the electric element, right?
Right.
And just because it had been like farmland at one point, and it was just out there. I also found this old kind of, not like fireball, but like this old like 19th century whiskey bottle, like that you'd carry around. So kind of like a cross between like a bottle and a flask. And Thoreau in his journals, I mean, not a lot would get Thoreau more excited than when he would find arrowheads. And that was big for me when we went out into like Western Massachusetts when I was a kid, was like looking for arrowheads. I thought that was like so natural and organic, but like romantic in a way too. And these home tools, it just drove my imagination so much.
I love that. Now the strangest one, I've been thinking about this since you suggested this idea years ago. I was walking along through the woods and found a shoe and a watch setting on top of it. Now, it wasn't an expensive watch, like a little Casio, but I was intrigued and then frightened that I was going to find a body or something else. And I never found anything other than that along that trail. I looked to the side of the path to make sure, but that one threw me for a bit of a loop.
Maybe someone just had a yearning to be free.
I think so. That was it. I've had enough of the man keeping me down by making me wear two shoes. I'll opt for one.
Yeah, I enjoyed being in the forest so much when I was a kid. Now, like, if I go up to Cape Ann to Dogtown, another one that was always dangerous to me, like, in a way, but not like that anything was going to happen, would be these spent shell casings.
Oh, yes.
And because, like, the woods were so deep, and it used to just blow my mind. It still does, like, when I'm hiking, like, Dogtown up in Gloucester, that someone is with a rifle hunting things, like, close to you. It just seems so easy to me to get taken out. Like, you rustle the wrong branch, doesn't it? Like, you would think that these would be activities that had no overlap and that you wouldn't have to, like, trust in the whole thing, like in Texas, that you can walk around with an AK-47 and you go into Starbucks and someone has an AK-47. I'd leave. I would never trust anybody not to just lose it and start shooting up the place. So I get wary when I'm in the woods, but you would see these casings of these spent shells, but you'd never see like a hunter. I just thought like that was like some bogeyman type of thing, like coming and planting these there, and you never saw them with the weaponry. And again, just the type of thing that fired my imagination and got me thinking in terms of story and who was behind that. And I always like got a charge out of finding like those shell casings.
I was like it too, just the simple arrangement of things in nature, perhaps a pile of rocks that someone has altered, or some way to lead you down a different path that always offers the opportunity for a new adventure.
Yeah, I agree. It's like when you're out there too and you're unsure of where you're going, like you'll do little things. Like you'll snap off a branch, or there'll be like some dead sort of like birch branch, right? And you'll just throw it in the middle of the path so you find that you're way out again, and just like little things like that. And when you spend a lot of time in the woods, I think, and I bring that Wall Street Journal up about that not too long ago, you start to see the world very differently because it makes you hyper observant. And it sounds weird to say that, like, okay, I'm in the woods, I'm seeing this, I'm hearing this, I now know what this bird is, I don't need to see it, I know there's a cardinal, I know where to look for it. Made me hear things like, I don't know, Beatles for Sale differently, right? Made me hear Bach differently. It made me hear elements of your voice, the tonal quality of your voice, your just the way you speak and the other meanings it might have in a conversation like this. So it's really, I think what it comes down to, where the gist of my idea here was, it speaks to how you can be present. I don't think we're very present all that often when you're out in the woods, because somebody just easily walks past the shell casing or walks past like the fake foot or whatever you happen to find in the shoe that weird ass day. But for everyone else, it's like you just go right by and you're not in that moment. It's not in that moment anywhere else.
I feel like I have an advantage in this because it's my nature. Part of it's because, you know, I'm older and I don't want to trip and fall down, but I tend to walk with my head down. So I'm always sort of looking on the ground to see what's ahead of me, and that's where often some of the best prizes are found.
Like in life, because you're dispirited, man?
I won't deny there's an element of that, no.
You know, it's funny you should mention that, because when I was going through with the whole horrible divorce thing and I thought that life couldn't get any worse, and I was oh so wrong, I would catch a glimpse of myself like in walking around the city, looking down in like windows, right? Just fronts of stores or whatever.
Yeah.
Street. I had to force myself, like I told myself internally, I said, you are going to walk with your head up. Like I had to make that formal decision. And sometimes I'd still catch myself, and it was integral to me, really. It was weird how that kind of accrued, which is a different thing than, of course, looking at the forest floor and being like, ooh, there's a slithering garter snake or whatnot.
You ever been lost in the woods?
Yeah, that's what the op-ed was about, actually. It was about being lost on purpose in the woods. Now, I don't mean like the outback, a place you might like never come out of. I mean like pretty low-key woods, you know what I mean? So worst case scenario, you pop out like 2 miles away from where you expect, you find a road, right? And then you can just make your way. But I find that when you're lost in the woods in that sense, that you have this ability to think that, I mean, you can learn to think that way elsewhere in life, and I did, but you're so in that moment. You're not thinking about coordinates. You're not thinking about time. You're not thinking about, I have to meet so-and-so at this place. You're just out there untethered. And when you are out there untethered, this is the value of it. There is no earthly way that the truth is not going to sidle up next to you. Like, it's a way to get in touch with pure truth without deciding to be like, okay, I'm facing this today. The truth just kind of, without your consent, I guess it's kind of like a truth rape, shows up and says, we're doing this. And you find that when you actually look at the truth, you're able to work your way through it. It's the problem, though, is getting started. So that was my big recommendation to people, is to get lost on purpose in the woods. I wonder if I'd be, like, legally liable if he, like, died or lost a toe or something. But I have no money, so come get me, I guess.
You're all set. There you go. Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. Well, let's move from the woods to Britain and the British films of the great Alfred Hitchcock. How do you distinguish those by films that were made in Britain?
Yes. So this would be like pre-Rebecca, so like pre-1940. And he had Silence in England, and a lot of people don't know the Silence he had. He was making them in the 20s. I had written about one of them for The Atlantic or somebody. I don't remember. The really nice version of The Lodger. But in the 1930s, of course, they were talkies. And so you can watch a bunch of these right now on the Criterion Channel, and it's stuff like The Lady Vanishes, one of the great train pictures, right?
Yeah.
Hard Day's Night is another great train picture. I tend to like films made on trains because you're all boxed in, and you have, like, built-in atmosphere, and it's a challenge to have a story come off in such a small space.
And you have the 39 Steps would be one of those, too, which is one of my favorite, not just Hitchcock films, but favorite films of all time.
And the original version of The Man Who Knew Too Much. And so what you're getting, really, I think, with the British Hitchcock films, I've been thinking a lot about this. You're getting, I think they're more interesting because they're more idiosyncratic. They use smaller and less predictable brushstrokes. So there's this essay by George Orwell, and he wrote it like around the time of World War II when Britain was getting heavily involved. And the essay was saying that British people are immune to things like fascism because they're so individualistic. Their interests are in their weird hobbies and the bicycling to mass through like the mist and everything and being an antiquarian, being an archivist, all those sorts of things that add up to their quirks. Like, if you think of a band like the Kinks, right, or the Zombies, they're just, like, such British bands. And I think this is why I've always found British things largely more interesting than American things, is because of that individual nature. So that's what you're getting with these Hitchcock pictures, whereas when he gets to America, they get really broad. And I'm not saying they're worse, although I think you could argue that the end of Psycho is probably like the worst ending of any well-known film, because all of the suspense has happened, the movie is over, and then you have to listen to like some dude explain everything to you in a really condescending way for like 12 minutes. Isn't like, that's weird. It's such a misstep for Hitchcock. And you have this feeling with the British pictures that he's freer. He's not trying to like appease the stupidest people out there, and I feel like he's doing that sometimes in the American films, and you don't need to do that. Sometimes you can be so great at your art that no matter how stupid people are, it's going to work on them. You have to trust in that, and I think sometimes he didn't. When he first got to America, he had a bad experience with David O. Selznick, who was the producer on Rebecca, and he was kind of like working for that man that you spoke of, and I think that ground a lot of the kind of quirks out of him. You see some of those quirks in his TV show, which they use the equipment to film Psycho. But there's a big difference between like those two eras of Hitchcock pictures, and people usually don't know the British ones at all. But like your favorite there, the 39 Steps, go fire that up. That's a really enjoyable film. Like, I mean, it's fun. It's suspenseful. You'll care about the characters. It's well written. It's everything you want in a picture.
Well, and one that would fall into that category, too, and I haven't seen it in, probably 25 years or so now. Also features one of my favorite character actors, Oscar Homolka, but Sabotage is a great film.
Yes. Yeah, that's another one. And it gets confusing, but he's like Sabotage and Saboteur. It's like, whoa, you really kind of like variations on that word. But there aren't really that many clunkers, and he was making more of them. There aren't that many clunkers within those 1930s British pictures. Like, you can look at kind of like runs that artists have, and they're usually like concentrated within like 2, 3, 4, 5 years, whether it's the Beatles or Shakespeare. Like, Shakespeare was really hot in 1599. I think I'm doing something quite a bit differently, and that's one of the reasons why I have the hope that I do have. But you could like sort of block Hitchcock's run from like 1934 to 1939 is a kind of apex for him, really. And then you can do it too later at the end of the 50s, right? You have the whole run earlier in the 50s with Rear Window in 54 and Vertigo in 57 and all that kind of stuff, culminating in Psycho in 1960. But the British run is just like chock-a-block with like masterpieces or near masterpieces.
Yeah, tense and wonderful and dark, although Rear Window, for me, probably my favorite movie of all time.
Well, the thing, too, about those Hitchcock films, the British ones, and I don't really see this in the American ones, they're funny.
That yes.
sounds like a weird thing to say, right? Like, he makes jokes in a really clever way. It's not just, like, the writing, but someone will say something, and then we'll cut to a different scene, and you'll see some visual rhyme, right, off of what somebody just said.
Right.
Like, there's, like, a double entendre in what someone says. And then you see, like, this cut to this, like, piston doing something. It's like, ha, 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 I see what you did there, naughty man. And there's that playfulness that you don't really have in... You see it a bit at the beginning of Rear Window, because if you think about it, and people tend not to notice this, when the movie starts, Jimmy Stewart looks up, and there's all this weird stuff happening overhead. You remember that?
Oh, yeah.
It's like, here's a helicopter. Here's, like, a rocket ship. It's like, where the hell does this dude live? It's like nothing that would, like, is he high? Like, what is happening? But it just kind of blends into the back of the movie. And it's like in Citizen Kane when the voiceover narration says, on the desert coast of Florida. What? I mean, there is no desert coast of Florida. So I always like that kind of thing, too.
But there's some great dialogue, not just with Jimmy Stewart and Grace Kelly, but anytime Thelma Ritter is in there, and Wendell Corey as well. They work in some very sly and funny bits.
Yeah, Wendell Corey had like a sad demise. He's like an alcoholic. Yeah. It was really like tough. But the things that Rear Window, there's quite a bit of similarity with the British picture in the silent era. Because think of how much of that film is so purely visual. Well, at the very beginning, right? So you get the weird bit. And then it's like camera goes here and it shows you like the magazine, right? Here's like camera goes to camera. And it just like, you know exactly what's happened. You know, like this guy is, this is what his job is.
Right. You see his photographs that he's taken.
Yeah. This is his girl. Right. And she's kind of fancy and he doesn't know if he wants to commit yet. Like, you know all of that within 20 seconds. And what Hitchcock called that was pure cinema.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he was doing in England. And he does it less in America, but Rear Window, I think it works so well in one way because he's doing that pure cinema bit again.
Absolutely. All right, let's move from Hitchcock to Van Gogh's Sunflower series.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this ever since my whole caper in the hallway with the sunflower murder about a week or two ago.
Have you caught the culprit yet?
The culprit might have been, I don't know. It might have been the water, but I don't mean to cast aspersions on anyone, but this little kid upstairs, I don't trust it as much as I used to. That's where I'd be leaning right now. Like, if my soul depended upon being correct about this, I would definitely... yeah, I have the child locked up. maybe, like, if somebody's going to quote me on that, maybe put it in context. Maybe don't isolate that. That would be great. Thanks. But I've always liked sunflowers personally so much myself because they straddle two worlds to me. And I think that's why Van Gogh liked them so much. And they're alive, right? But they're delicately alive. They strike me as, if they were humans, they would be very feeling humans. And I have a lot of respect for that. But they're also, like, perched between this kind of, like, life and death States, and people think about the term going to seed. That comes from our friend the sunflower, because they even kind of decay or die beautifully, right? Like when you see most dead flowers, Stone Song, you think like, oh, that looks horrible. But like a dead sunflower has something poetic about it. And Van Gogh's goal is interesting how he came to sunflowers. He thought, okay, none of this is working out, all this whole painting thing that I've been doing. I'm going to become known as the guy who paints a certain kind of flower. So he goes through like a bunch of other flowers, like he's workshopping these flowers. None of them worked. He was like contrasting colors. And I thought what was so brilliant about this is he did these studies in the late 1880s of sunflowers. And sometimes he would paint the entire canvas and it would all be the same color. The foreground, the background, right? The middle ground, the sunflowers themselves, and the vase. Oh, that's radical, right? That's like taking at the end of Handel's Messiah when he has the Amen chorus. And it's just everything. It's a world built off of one word. And you could see, having read like some of the fiction I've been doing lately, why I would really think quite highly of that, why that would sort of stick out to me, because that's not what other people are able to do. And he would build it all off that one color.
Do you have a favorite from the series?
I would say probably one of those two where it's just that sort of monochromatic look. And what he did was, Van Gogh would get in trouble with people because people would say to him, like people used to say to me, you can't go that fast. How good could it be if you go that fast? I had like an editor once who said, you could only write two good stories a year and you'd have to work on each one for 6 months. And it's like, yeah, no, you, and they'd still suck, but like, Schubert would hang up your coat when you came to visit him, and he would literally write a piano sonata in his head because he was Schubert. So what Van Gogh did is he painted really fast. And this most, for the most part, the two, it's like one big series, two smaller series, but the sunflower painting, it's wet on wet painting. And what that means is you're actually not waiting for the paint to dry. You're painting wet paint on top of still wet paint. And to do that, you can't let that bottom layer dry. That's why, like, the works, they look, they have this sheen to them, sans impasto, that you wouldn't expect them. They look like sunflowers kind of billowing in the sun of a window in an apartment or a house or whatever. And that's because he was able to take something that people considered, like, this criticism and turn it into this obvious strength. But yeah, I would say the ones he did where it's just that monochromatic, but it's the variations on it's fugato. It's this color fugue. And Bach, writer of Art of Fugue, would be able to look at this and be like, oh yeah, you're painting what I'm composing, which I just think is great.
Colin Fleming, check out his work at colinflemminglit.com. Subscribe to the Many Moments More blog as well. Colin, we thank you as always, and we'll check in again with you next Tuesday.
Okay, sounds good.
Colin Fleming on Dantown.